If you've not yet signed up for the student retreat, January 10, 11, and 12, be sure to do that this week before you go home. Those of you who are students, Landon Saunders will be the guest speaker for those 3 days. The cost is $15. You may sign up here on the bulletin board by the office, or you may sign up in the student personnel office on campus. Already about 100 have signed up, and we're off to an excellent start, and we want to urge you, if you're going, be sure to sign up before you leave for the holiday vacation. With the return of Jesus on this occasion to Jerusalem, the simple, uncomplicated earlier months of Jesus' life came to a close. We saw him in chapter 1 meet men and invite them to be a part of his company. In chapter 2, we saw him as he went to a wedding in Cana and graciously supplied the wants and needs of the party. And in the latter part of that chapter, saw him take a whip and show us a different side of his personality as he drove out of the temple those who would deprive God of his rightful honor and would deprive people of their needs. As he took a whip and lashed out at those people who would be self-appointed keepers of the temple, who had not the Spirit of God in them. Then in chapter 3, we watched as he and Nicodemus talked at night. We saw this one come, whom we described as one who was on the outside looking in, one who was trying to live the new life without the new heart, and watched him as he stood in amazement at Jesus as he talked about a new birth, and went away not realizing that the very process that he couldn't understand was already beginning to work in his own life, and it became evident later. And then we saw Jesus as he saw the storm clouds gathering in Jerusalem withdraw from Judea and go into Galilee. We watched him pass through Samaria, come in contact with half-breeds, stay 2 days with them, and we watched his overwhelming desire to bring people to eternal life outweigh his desire and his need for actual physical food. And he explained it to his disciples by saying, "Well, I have food to eat that you don't know about." So I say that those early, simple days, and they were early, and they were simple, they were uncomplicated, but they're finished, they're forever gone. No more would he ever have the leisure that he enjoyed during those early months. The Jewish mind has already been set against him now. They already have enough evidence against him that they're wanting to kill him. And all they're looking for now is an excuse. And they find that excuse in this incident that we've just heard read by Steve Autry. And thank you, Steve. That was a good reading. He told you about the man, the lame man, at the pool of Bethesda. This happened on the Sabbath day. And if you pick that up out of the text, it's mentioned 2 or 3 times that Jesus did this on the Sabbath. And that's very significant because this was the fly in the ointment. This was what they seized upon as their excuse to jump with both feet on Jesus. But actually, this served them only as a temporary thing. This didn't really, it wasn't permanent. For they only used it as a springboard to get to him on a more serious charge. The reason why I say this is because at his crucifixion, the trial that preceded it did not bring out anything about his Sabbath conduct. I don't think I'm wrong, but I don't believe that there was a single incident where they said to him at his trial, "You broke the Sabbath." Even though here, John uses the imperfect tense of the verb, which means that he broke the Sabbath repeatedly, not just a one-time thing. He was always breaking the Sabbath, is what the force of the word is. And he was, according to their thinking. He was either rubbing, you know, with his disciples, and they were rubbing corn through their hands, or they were healing someone, or doing something on the Sabbath day, and it always infuriated these people. But this really wasn't the issue that was the burning issue. The burning issue that finally sealed his doom was the claim that he made to be one with God. That was what caused him to be cut off from among the people. And at his trial, it is this that was brought up when they asked him, are you the Christ, the Son of the Most High? And he said, "I am." And from henceforth you'll see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. And the old priest just literally tore his garments. He was so infuriated and so upset because of this claim. They denounced him as a blasphemer. But you see, that was the culmination of all of it. This all began back here. And John, the fifth chapter, is one of the places where it began. Now, back in chapter 2, when he had said, if you destroy this temple, I'll raise it up in 3 days. They used that, or tried to use it at his trial, but they got it all jumbled up and they didn't agree in their testimony. This incident here in John 5 is really the very first occasion where he really and truly bore down on his identity and let them know who he was. I want you to mark a box around verse 17. For it's this that is the pivotal point in John, the fifth chapter. Jesus is saying here, my Father is working until this time, and I'm working too. That's what they seized upon. Oh, he had done this thing on the Sabbath, and it says that that he did this, and they were persecuting him because he had broken the Sabbath. But then in verse 17, he says, well, my Father's working still, and I'm working too. That's when it says, then they sought all the more to kill him. Because he not only broke the Sabbath, but he made God his Father, making himself equal with God. And this was something that was so absolutely forbidden. They wouldn't allow it. This was blasphemy. This was what they considered to be worthy of death. And so they condemned him. The thing that I think probably infuriated them was something that is said in here that is either a reflection of what he said or is a reflection of how they heard him. I don't know which it is because it's spoken in the indirect. It's not a quote. It just simply says that he made God idion. He made God his own Father. This is what it says was their reaction, at least, to what he had said. And it is this in a very strange way. They were saying, this man claims that God is his own Father. In other words, in a peculiar sense. We get the word idiot from this word, idion, meaning peculiar, meaning that which pertains to the same thing. It pertains to that person only. It's his idiosyncrasy. They were saying, this man has an idiosyncrasy about him. He thinks that God is his Father alone, in a contrast to the way God is the Father of us all. And that's what seemed to have infuriated them so. Now, not only does it say that he said that, or does that was their impression of it, but it says that he made this claim often. He made this claim repeatedly, because here again, the imperfect tense of the verb means that he didn't just make this claim once, that he was always claiming that God was his personal, peculiar Father in a way that it was different from the way other people held him as Father or had him as Father. So we find Jesus actually coming to this point in his life, and we find them just pouncing upon him with both feet. The mind of these people was set. They already had made up their minds what they were going to do. But I also want you not only to underline verse 17, but underline verses 19 and 30. Because in both of these verses, you have a statement that must be read, and they must be taken in the context, or the other things that he said must be taken in the context of these two statements. They both say virtually the same thing. I can of myself do nothing. Now, that's a very unusual statement. I first heard this statement, really, when Terry read it on campus about 3 years ago. He read that and said, who do you think said that? I can of myself do nothing. And I thought, well, Paul probably said that. But it wasn't. Jesus said it. Jesus is saying the Son can of his own authority do nothing. Only what he sees the Father doing, that's what he can do. And I can of myself do nothing, only what I hear. That's what I'm going to judge. My judgment, is just because I don't seek to do my own will, but the will of him that sent me. Now, both of these statements are contained in this conversation here of Jesus with the Jews. They're important because they immediately remove any charge that the Jews might have made against Jesus, that he was an egomaniac. They might have said, you claim to be the Son of God in a peculiar way. Who do you think you are? And they did ask that in chapter 8. But here he says, now look, here's the relationship. My Father and I are working. He's working. I'm working. But I can't do anything on my own authority. I'm just doing what I've seen him do. Now these two statements, I can of myself do nothing, one stands at the head of those claims that he makes. The other stands at the head of the witnesses that he calls. And I want you to notice them tonight in that context. One of them, where he says, I can of myself do nothing, stands at the head of a whole paragraph of claims that he makes that are peculiar and unique and absolutely damning. As far as he was concerned, they killed him. The second was the beginning of a paragraph that brought forth the testifiers or the testimony of those who bore witness to him. And I want you to notice with me just for a moment tonight. Jesus' defense was no defense at all. This thing that I mentioned about this being the chapter heading of his defense. And when I went back and read what he said, I realized that, by the way, Jesus' defense wasn't a defense at all. Had there been a lawyer or a solicitor standing up to make this defense for, or to make a defense of Jesus, had there been someone standing up to explain what he had done on the Sabbath and why he did it, and had Jesus said, just a moment, I'll just speak for myself, and this man who was the hired lawyer sat down and listened to this man make his own defense, when Jesus would have said these things that he said here, the man would have just put his hand over his face and said, oh no, sit down, you're hanging yourself. You've ruined it all. That's the nature of what he says here. Let me show you how he did it. He used an illustration. We're not familiar with it, but they were familiar with it. He uses the apprentice system. He uses the apprentice system of the Jewish economy to illustrate the relationship between him and his father. Now, the apprentice system, even in New Zealand, it doesn't hold true. The apprentice system is there too, but it's not the kind that the Jewish economy had. The Jewish economy was this. The father of the family taught his sons his trade. And then they taught their sons. And there was this whole guild of people, and they were always a family guild, way on down through the generations, the father handing it on to the son. Now, in verses 19 and 20, Jesus just simply says, truly I say to you, the Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever he does, that the Son does likewise. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing. And he uses this apprentice system, but what he uses to illustrate absolutely infuriates, because they knew full well what he was saying. When he was saying, look, I'm just in the apprenticeship of my Father, I'm just watching everything that he does. And he says, now the Father loves the Son, and he shows him all these things that he's doing. And they just stand there and listen to this man brag about how God, his own Father, they said, in a peculiar way, is showing him all these intimate things about how to do this, all that, and the other. And they just absolutely, it burns them up. They can't stand it. Because they knew the hours that a father had to spend with his son in order to pass those arts and crafts on down to the son below them, you know. And they knew how that this father would take this little tyke from his youth on up and would spend hours and hours and days and months and years showing him how to do just everything, just like his father did it. And Jesus said, that's the way my father's working with me, and I'm just doing what I've seen my father do. And it just absolutely burned them up. They couldn't stand it. So what he uses to illustrate really infuriates. And then, not only does he claim to have this apprenticeship relationship with his father, but he then cashes in on it and claims the ultimate implications of this very intimate relationship with his father as an apprentice, watching his father and seeing what he's doing. And he said, then I'm just doing what I've seen my father do. Not only does he do that, he says, I'm going to tell you something else. You haven't seen anything yet. Look at the latter part of verse 20 says, for the father loves the son and loves and shows him all that he himself is doing. But the last part of verse 20 says, and greater works than these will he show him, that you may marvel. In other words, he's saying, if you thought that healing of the man at the pool of Bethesda was something, you just wait. You haven't seen anything yet. You wait till I show you the other things that he's shown me to do for you. And then he does. He lays it on them. Number one, he claims, there are two things under this. He claims here prerogatives that belong only to God. And I'm serious. There's not a higher claim that he could have made than the claims that he makes. And he says, these are that which come from my relationship with my father as my being his apprentice. He says, that which you saw at the pool of Bethesda wasn't anything. You watch what I'm going to show you now. And he makes two claims to things that God alone can do. Number one, he says that I'm going to be able to raise the dead. I am going to raise the dead. Look at verse 22 or verse 21. For as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, so also the Son gives life to whom he will. Have you ever heard of such a thing as that? And I know they must have sat there or stood there with bated breath listening to this man as he hung himself. And as they were perhaps saying, listen to him. He claims to be raising the dead. On down in the chapter in verse 25, Jesus talks about a resurrection that now is. Truly, truly, I say to you, the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those that hear will live. He's talking about the resurrection that he was performing at that time. You know who he was talking about? Oh, that whole company of people that kept increasing at such a fantastic rate. Mary Magdalene, Nicodemus, and all these that were dead in sin and dead under the law. He began to arouse these people and give to them life, and they began to follow them around. And these who had had demons possessing them, and those who had been lepers, and those who had been dead in sin, he began to say to them, come on, come on, go with me. Follow me. Follow me, Peter. Follow me, Andrew, James, John, y'all, come on, follow me. And these guys who had been so dead in sin, they began to wake up, and their eyes began to be opened, you know, and they began to see things. And Mary Magdalene, a prostitute, this beautiful gazelle, perhaps, who had a broken leg that people were praying on, he took that child and made her whole again. And the woman that was taken in adultery, he said, come on, I don't condemn you. Don't you sin anymore now. And he gave her a brand new lease on life, and these people began to wake up all over the community, and they began to follow him in droves, and they began to come out in such numbers that he couldn't even go into the cities anymore. That's what he meant here by the hour is coming, and now is when the dead that hear my voice will come forth, and those that hear it shall live. And man, he meant just that. He was giving them life, and he came, he said, that they might have life and have it more abundantly. And I'll tell you what, the witnesses that could begin to say, yes, he made me alive, He woke me up. He restored me. All these people began all through the community to begin to testify and bear witness. You know, he's doing it. He claimed to do it, and now he's doing it. There's a second resurrection, though. He doesn't just stop by saying that I'm influencing people for life. He says, I'm going to raise them from the tombs. And that's found in verse 28. Don't marvel, he said at this, the fact that he was raising people to spiritual life. He said, don't marvel at that. He said, the hour is coming when all who are in the tombs will hear his voice and come forth. Those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those that have done evil to the resurrection of judgment. And I can just see those people saying, this is ridiculous. This is as far as I plan to go. I don't plan to hear any more of that. He was claiming that he was going to be the one on the day of judgment or on the day of the resurrection to raise the people from the tombs. And he said, all, that means everybody of every nation, of every tribe, of every tongue. He says, all who are in the graves are going to hear my voice and are going to come forth to the judgment. Those who have done good to everlasting life, those who have done evil to everlasting judgment. Can you imagine the claims that this man makes? Well, that's the first thing. That's the first prerogative that belonged only to God that this Jew from Nazareth claimed rested upon him. He said, I am the one who raises the dead and gives them life, just like my Father has raised the dead and has given them life. The second thing he says was that the Father has committed into my hand all judgment. He said, the Father doesn't judge anybody, but he has committed all judgment into the Son or unto the Son, so that all who honor the Father may honor the Son as well. And then he says also, he has given judgment into the hands of the Son of Man, look at verse 27, and has given him authority to execute judgment because he is the Son of Man. Now here, not only does he state that he's going to raise the dead now, spiritually, he says, I'm going to raise the dead in the day of the resurrection. I'll be the one that will call them forth. It will be my voice that they hear. And then he says, not only that, but the Father has given into the hands of the Son all judgment. So that all people who have honored the Father will honor the Son as well. And then he says, I've been given this judgment, the authority to execute it, because I'm the Son of Man. Now, only a Jew would understand what was meant by the Son of Man here. When he claimed to be the Son of Man, he wasn't putting himself down on a pedestal lower than the claim to be the Son of God. Because, you see, the Son of Man was a messianic name or a messianic nomenclature, what do you call it, a messianic designation, that came out of Daniel. Daniel, the 7th chapter, verses 12 and 13, or beginning in verse 13 and 14. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days, and he was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and kingdom, that all the peoples and nations and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. This was the Son of Man that Daniel had prophesied was going to come. And whenever the people looked for the Messiah, they looked for him under this designation. He was to be the Son of Man. And here this man who called himself more than he called himself the Son of God, he called himself the Son of Man because the Jews were looking for this Son of Man. And so in effect, what he's claiming to be here is the Messiah. He says, I'm going to raise the dead. I'm going to judge the dead, the living and the dead. I'm going to judge everybody. And this judgment has been given to me because I am the Christ. I'm the Son of God. I'm the Son of Man. I'll tell you what, there was nothing left undetermined here. There was nothing left undecided. There was no uncertainty here at all. This man was claiming it all. Listen to these claims, if you will. in just in summary, he claimed to be free of obligation to the Sabbath. He claimed to be exempt from the Sabbath. That's what they were after him about. He claimed in another occasion, he says, I am Lord of the Sabbath. Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. So actually what he's doing here is claiming to be exempt from the Sabbath. And then the last part of verse 18, he claimed that God was his own father in a peculiar way, making himself equal with God. That's the second claim. In verse 19, he says, I'm doing only what the Father is doing in front of me, and I've seen him do. In verse 20, he says, the Father loves me and is showing me all that he himself is doing. The latter part of verse 20, he says that greater things than this will he do for me, that you may marvel. Verse 21, he says that the Father raises the dead, gives them life, so the Son raises the dead and gives them life. The Father judges no one, but's given all judgment into the hands of the Son. And he makes these claims, and then verse 23, he puts it all under one heading and says, if you don't accept me, you've rejected God. Now listen to how he says it. The latter part of verse 23, he who does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him. Do you wonder why they killed him? I don't. I wonder how he lived as long as he did. And were it not for the fact that it was in the hands of the Father, the hour that he was to be delivered up, they would have killed him long before they killed him. His hour just hadn't come. He just go and come as he pleased because of the fact that it was determined that he was not going to die outside of Jerusalem or outside the city, that he died outside the city, but he was not going to die any other place than Jerusalem, and he was not going to die any other time but the Passover feast. All of this was determined by God, and all of this kept him, and had it not been for that, this man would have been killed long ago. He would have been killed long before he was. So, we find that this claim that he makes, and these claims that he makes, look at them, they're ultimate. They're the highest. They're the most that he could ever claim. And I won't review them again, but just let it just be sufficient to say he was claiming for himself the absolute ultimate that any human being that was on the face of the earth had ever claimed. No one dared claim the things that he claimed. All right? Then consequently, the next thing that you want to notice in this chapter is that he called on witnesses that were the ultimate. You see, it wasn't sufficient to back these claims with witnesses that were less than the ultimate. Consequently, he has out of four witnesses, he eliminates two of them. You won't accept two of them. These four witnesses are these. Well, two of them that he eliminates are these. And let me say this, that he eliminates them not because they were unworthy or untrustworthy or unreliable. He just eliminates them because they were not acceptable to the people who were his critics. That's all the reason why he rejected them. You see, Jesus didn't want his critics to be gullible. He wasn't after them to be blind and just swallow anything that he said. He didn't expect them to do anything less than what reason would allow and what the law of Moses would dictate. And the law said you've got to have two witnesses. And so Jesus had two, but he eliminates two. He eliminates himself. He says in verse 31, if I bear witness to myself, my testimony is not true. Now, that really wasn't right. For later on, he says, even if I do bear witness to myself, I know where I came from. But what he's saying here, in this translation that you read from, says, if I bear witness to myself, my witness isn't valid. It's not accepted, is what he was saying. It wouldn't be valid in the eyes of the people who were the critics. Consequently, he says, I don't care. Don't worry about me bearing witness to myself. I don't need that. I've learned in the life of Jesus Christ that he'd give away everything but the truth. He'd give away anything but the truth. His own honor, his own things that pertain to him. He didn't have anything. He didn't have any axe to grind. And I've learned that, by the way, in dealing with people, if you'll give away everything but the truth, just concede everything but the truth. Concede it all. He could have said, you're going to listen to me and I'm going to tell you who I am. Not Jesus. He said, I don't care whether you listen to me or not. Or he could have said, listen here, John the Baptist came and God sent him and you're going to listen to him or else. No, he said, I don't care whether you listen to John or not. You went to him for a while. And you listen to him, but I've got a witness better than that. And then he mentioned the two witnesses that he would accept, in which he drove home and demanded that they consider. Number one, he said, the works that I do, they bear witness to me. And you know, these people couldn't deny his works. They couldn't deny them. Nicodemus came to Jesus in chapter 3 that night and said, we know that you're a teacher come from God. You couldn't do the things you do unless God were with you. Nicodemus got the message. Others, though, saw the same miracles, the same signs, and said, ah, he's doing this by Beelzebul, the prince of demons. Oh, what do you mean? What is he doing by Beelzebul? You know what? I'd love to have asked those characters that said that in John 12. Wait a minute. You say he's doing this in the name of Beelzebub. What is he doing in the name of Beelzebub? You see what they're doing here? Unknowingly, these people who were his enemies were bearing witness to the fact that he did something. Had they said, well, he hadn't done anything yet, then I would have had to say, well, they were there and they said he didn't do anything. But look, every one of them had to acknowledge the fact that this man was doing something. And they didn't know they were going to be recorded. They didn't know all this was going to be for posterity. And so here they were trying to explain away what he was doing. But the funny thing about it is that by their doing this, unknowingly, they bore witness to the fact that he was doing it. Right now, it's inconsequential as to where the source was or what the source was. Jesus took them to task and said, well, that's the silliest thing I ever heard of. These things, my casting out demons by a demon? He said, a house divided against itself can't stand. A kingdom divided against itself is fall; it will fall. He said, why, my goodness, Satan's kingdom is at an end then if I, by Satan, am casting out Satan. And he showed them how silly their reasoning was. Grown men. But beside the point, that's not the issue right now. What I want you to see was that he was doing something. And they tried to explain it away. But nevertheless, he was doing it. And they could not deny that he was doing it. They tried to identify the source as being something other than God, but they couldn't deny that he was doing it. It's like the resurrection. There have been a lot of theories proposed by men trying to explain the empty tomb. Let them go on and explain it. Let them revel in it. I don't care. It just tickles me to death that they find something that they have to explain. I've never seen one of them yet bring us the body and say the tomb isn't empty. Here it is. No, and by their efforts to make theories as to why the tomb was empty, and they go into all these details about the swoon theory and the resuscitation theory, and what's the problem? The problem was that the grave was empty, and people have from the time of the acknowledging of it or the being aware of it to this present day made up theories as to why it was empty. Let them go on and try. The fact still remains true, it was empty, and they never did find his body. So they can't deny his works. He says, that's my first, that's it. But then he said, the scriptures. That's the other witness. He said, I'm not going to accuse you to God. Moses is the one that's going to accuse you. You've put your hope in Moses. He says, you search the scriptures because in them you think you have eternal life. But these are they which testify of me, and you won't come to me that you might have life. He said, you're like monkeys looking at a telescope. You're like monkeys, you're like dumb animals looking at a telescope, looking at it, but never looking through it. He said, you claim to study, or you study the scriptures, you search them diligently, because you think that in them you have eternal life. But he says, these are they simply which look at me, and you won't come to me that you might have life. Harris J. Dark, some 25 years ago, made a survey of the Old Testament prophecies and came out with the figure there are 432 prophecies in the Old Testament prophesying of the coming of the Christ, the Jewish Messiah. And then being a mathematician as he was, as well as a very famous, fine Christian man and a preacher, this man did a calculation and said there's not one chance in 10,000 that Jesus, the Jew from Nazareth, is not the Christ, the Messiah of the Old Testament. There's not a chance in 10,000 that he's not the Messiah. But you think these people could see it? No, they couldn't see it. Jesus makes these ultimate claims. Claims to be exempt from the Sabbath, claims to be the one who will call the dead out of the tombs, then that he'll be the one to judge the dead, that the Father and he are on terms like this that are so intimate that the Father shows him everything that he's doing and he's just imitating his Father. All these claims that are ultimate, then he makes these ultimate call or this ultimate call for these ultimate witnesses. He discounts himself. He discounts John the Baptizer. He says, I'll accept two witnesses only. My works, which you can't deny, he says. And then second, he says, the scriptures. If you just read the scriptures, you'd know where I came from. And so he places it right where it ought to be. Then finally, he simply countercharges and says, here's why you don't believe. And in verses 42, 44, and 46, he gives three charges why they didn't believe. Number one, you don't have the love of God in your heart. You don't love God. Now, he was talking to religious people here. You don't love God, he says. Second, you're seeking honor from men, not the honor that comes from the only God. And third, he says, you don't even believe the Bible. You don't believe the scriptures. So he countercharges and said, here's why you don't believe me. It's not because I haven't done the works necessary to satisfy the most critical mind. It's not because I haven't fulfilled the scriptures that any nitpicking person who is so specific and intent on, sir, that's not why I fulfill those. He says, here's why you don't accept me. Number one, you don't have any love for God in your hearts. Number two, you seek glory from men and not from God. And number three, you don't even believe the scriptures that you claim that you believe. He says Moses is going to accuse you before God the Father. Because if you'd believed him, you'd believe me. Because he wrote about me. Listen to this man say, he wrote, Moses, 1,500 years earlier, he said, wrote about me. And he stood there and almost dared them to do anything to him. He just simply stated it just like it was. That's the one we're serving. Man, that's my Lord. That's your Lord. Someone that history bears record of way on back, thousands of years, who made claims like this that are absolutely preposterous? Yeah. But he called in upon evidence that could not be denied? Yeah. And for historical verification by writings that were 1,500 years old? Yeah. And then turns and says, you don't believe because you don't love God, you don't believe the Scripture, and you're seeking to be honored by each other, and you don't care anything about the honor from God. Now let me speak to those of you who are not yet Christians. We're going home in a few days. You are, those of you who are students. And every year someone is either in a wreck or perhaps killed or maimed or perhaps injured for life. You may not even get back. We've studied enough in the life of Jesus up to this point that I feel it's appropriate now to urge you. Why don't you act on your faith? What do you think about Jesus? Have you come to any conclusion about him yet? Are you beginning to see something about him that makes you say, you know, I'm beginning to believe that. I really am. Perhaps it's already come to the point that you say, wait, don't let me leave tonight. I'm too close. I want to be his disciple. Boy, we'd love to have you as a part of the body here. We love you, and we love a Lord that loves you. And you can see the kind of man he is. My goodness, you can see the kind of a God he is. Wouldn't you want to serve that kind of a God? I don't want to serve any other kind of a God but the one I see in Jesus Christ. What about you? If you've come to believe in him tonight and through the weeks as we've studied and watched him and as your faith now culminates, is it to the blooming point where you say, you know, I want to express it. I want to confess my faith in him. We're going to give you that opportunity tonight. And I want you to think about it in terms of you going away. You might not ever be back. You may not choose to come back. But you're nearer the kingdom, perhaps, than you've ever been in your life. Wouldn't you like to come tonight and say, look, I want to be a Christian? It's so beautifully easy. He's made it so simple. He requires all of you. He wants every part of you, but that's all he wants of you. No, you don't have to go out and buy something or go through some absolutely monstrosity. That's not it. He just wants you. And he asks if you'll come and make your confession of him and then be buried with him in a grave like he was in a symbol of it, and be united with him there and raised to walk this new life, that you'll be his and he'll take you with him. He'll raise you up in the last day. In fact, he says, you'll have passed from death to life. You won't even go into the judgment, he says, if you just simply become his. You've got a punched one-way ticket to heaven if you'll just stay with him. Wouldn't you like to do that? And we give you that opportunity now, right now. Won't you come and do it right now while we stand and sing?